wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Sanity stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message breakup. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, buy a Coke, buy a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned baby.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's the drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Kindness, right?
And ratings
pressures.
News Goop.
What we need to know.
News Goop.
What we want to know.
We got News.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN-FM. And every week, the News Dissector show is now amalgamated with the MediaChannel.org program. So we're happy to have you on board. And today we're going to be having a very interesting program. I'll tell you about it in a minute. In the interim, I just urge you to visit MediaChannel.org online and get a sense of what you think about it, and also the range of articles, the range of information about the media, as well as some of our the transcripts of our prior radio shows, as well as some of our video interviews with key people talking about the way media covers major issues. So that's all on MediaChannel.org. Check it out, subscribe to it, become part of it if you can. Today, I don't know if our guests are here. Hello.
Hi, this is Mike Hopp.
Hi, Mike. How are you? Hold one second. Nobody told me you were here, but we're going to introduce you properly in one second. Joining me on the radio today to talk about media, to talk about the biggest issue in media, which is the Comcast merger and what that Comcast merger means and doesn't mean, is Michael Copps, the former member of the FCC. He's one of the served as a member of the FCC for quite some time. His tenure was marked by a consistent embrace of the public interest as a strong voice in opposition to the consolidation of the media. He notably dissented in the Comcast-NBC Universal merger. He's been a consistent proponent for localism in programming and diversity in media ownership. Although retired from the commission, he's maintained his commitment to an inclusive, informative media landscape. In addition to leading Common Cause's Media Reform Initiative, he sits on the boards of Free Press and Public Knowledge. Prior to his time at the FCC, he served as the Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Trade Development in the Department of Commerce and Chief of Staff to Senator Fritz Hollings, a Democrat of South Carolina from the early 70s to 1983. He has a PhD in history from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Quite a lot of credentials and quite a lot of experience. Welcome, Michael, to News Dissector Media Channel Radio. And we'd like to begin by asking you to give us an assessment of where we are on this merger that is proposed between Comcast and Time Warner Cable.
Well, first of all, thank you for the very nice introduction and the opportunity to be on your show, and my thanks to you for continuing to give such wonderful coverage to an issue which I believe is as important as any confronting the United States right now. The Comcast-Time Warner merger is up for decision now. The official proposal, papers proposing it, were presented the day before yesterday to the Department of Justice and to the Federal Communications Commission. The Department of Justice will be examining it on antitrust grounds. The Federal Communications Commission will be looking at it from some competitive standpoints, but more specifically from a public interest perspective. Does this deal inure to the public interest, to consumers, to citizens?
So let's remind people that we're talking about a $45 billion transaction that will affect millions of consumers and further pad some very well-lined pockets. The Congress, it seems to be getting a taste of the lobbying money that and campaign money donated by Comcast. But beyond that, we're in a situation where Comcast's position, as I understand it, is there's no danger here of further media concentration. There's no danger here of anything that could impact negatively on the public. Is that not true? And yet,
it is certainly not. You know, I've been hearing that song for I served for almost 11 years at the Federal Communications Commission, and a large and unexpected part of my tenure there was listening to CEOs of the few big media companies who increasingly control our civic dialogue and our news and information. And so often I'd hear, "Oh, this is the last time we're going to be here. You know, this is the end of consolidation." And it just keeps on going and going and going. And the first 8 years I was there with a Republican majority at the commission, and they seldom found a merger that they didn't like. I thought things would change for the better after the 2008 elections, and we got a Democratic majority at the FCC. But shortly after that new majority took place, or took office, Comcast came knocking on the door with the NBC Universal merger, and as you mentioned, I opposed that. I was the only commissioner to vote against that, but I looked at the transformative nature of what was being proposed. You know, this wasn't just a cable company coming in for another merger, bad as that might have been, but this was a company that was wanting to get its hands on a lot of content, all of the properties of the National Broadcasting Company, Universal Studios, all these stations and channels and everything. So it was new media, it was old media. Comcast is a huge provider of internet, so it's broadband as well as broadcast, it's content and distribution. And you know, they said, well, we're willing to entertain a few conditions on that. But I took a look at that, and I thought there's just no way to make this serve the public interest. This is giving one company just too much power and influence. But anyhow, the majority approved it. Comcast bought the first 51%, and then last year they bought the last 49% from GE, and I thought, well, we won't be hearing much more from them anymore. They must be about out of money. But lo and behold, they come now saying, well, we've got $45 billion more, and we want to buy Time Warner Cable and get bigger and bigger and put that huge footprint that we have with Comcast, NBC, Universal, the content,
what's your
the distribution, the broadband, and we want to take that from the area of the country where we're primary now and put it over much of the rest of the country. And yet they have the gall, I guess I would call it, to argue that this isn't anti-competitive because Comcast and Time Warner Cable don't compete in one another's markets. But how can you call it? How can you call that pro-competitive when you're taking that one footprint that has a monopoly, one or so much power in one part of the country, and putting that power across another vast swath of the country and controlling so many markets? It's just unfathomable to me.
I'd like to, you know, I have a small dog in this hunt, Michael. I'm a Time Warner Cable customer, okay? And not a very happy one. Apparently, Time Warner Cable has among the most complaints on record for customers of cable services. People are not terribly happy, and I've seen the costs of cable continue to rise significantly over the course of my, being involved with Time Warner Cable. I really didn't have much choice, and I've had a lot of frustrating experiences with them. But leaving all of that aside, there are some unsavory aspects of this deal that I wanted you to help us understand. First, we have Time Warner. This has a new CEO. He's just been, CEO for a few weeks, okay? And there's now suddenly other cable companies are going after him. And he's saying, no, we're not going to sell, okay? We believe in our customers and all the rest of that. Then there's a quick turnaround, and suddenly, not only does he sell, but it emerges that he has a big, sweet part of the sale, that he stands to gain significantly financially for just the 6 weeks' work, you know, with a massive payment that he gets as a executive of Time Warner. So here we have people who have clear self-interest making decisions for the rest of us that seem very sleazy. Am I wrong about that?
Well, here's the thing. You know, we're all used to witnessing the power of money, and we've seen so many industries consolidate, so many industries combine, and it seems to be in the drinking water of capitalism. And we decided a long time ago as a country, for better or for worse, that our communications infrastructure was going to be part of that capitalistic system. And as part of that, people fight for market control, they fight for gatekeeper control. But where you have to draw the line, even if you're going to accept that, is that at some point these companies become so powerful, get such market control, or monopolies or oligopolies or whatever you want to call them, and yet they want to be totally unregulated. They don't want any public interest oversight, and that's what the Comcast and the AT&Ts and the Verizons and some of the big internet companies too seem to be going toward. But here's the difference. When we're talking about communications and media, we're talking about a public resource. These people are using the airwaves that belong to you and to me, and the FCC has jurisdiction over the airwaves and the wires and the cables. So it's a public resource that we're talking about, and it's supposed to be producing a public good. It's supposed to be producing an informed citizenry. It's supposed to be covering local events. It's supposed to be reflecting the great diversity of our cultures and its broadcasting, and all of this diversity and localism and competition that is really the definition of the public interest here is going by the boards right now. So we're really at an inflection point, I think, with this merger and with the other major decision that's facing the FCC now in the future of the open internet, so-called network neutrality. The decisions that are going to be made here in the next few months are going to determine the direction of our news and information infrastructure, our communications ecosystem for years to come. So that's why I'm going around the country and trying to get people organized and mobilized to express their opinions, develop a grassroots movement, and try to get this media system of ours on the road to representing small g democracy.
Now, you know, I first heard about Comcast. I really didn't know much about them. I'm visiting Philadelphia and speaking to some media activists there who told me that they were completely hostile. They were a very hostile company to anything that folks there wanted to do in terms of access, in terms of social responsibility on the part of the media companies. You know, they had the power, they had the monopoly, and they wanted to lord it over people. So, you know, soon this local company supposedly becomes a national company. Where do they get the $45 billion? Is that money that they borrow, or is that money that they actually have stashed away?
Well, I don't know the exact financial details. They just submitted the papers on this thing that's going to finance the deal, but they are effective business people. They know what they're doing. They have a strategy. They know how to influence public policy. And again, you can't criticize all of these things and hold that unilaterally responsible for where we are, because the great shortfall here is in the public sector. It's not in the private sector. It's in the public sector that's supposed to control things like that. So when a company gets that big and wields that much power, no matter the means they used to get there, we have to have some public interest oversight to protect the interests of the American people and to advance the common good. And instead, we've had a Federal Communications Commission that blesses all of these mergers, or almost all of them, and at the same time whittles away all of the public interest guidelines it once had to bring some responsibility and some obligations into, for example, the use of our broadcast networks. You used to have to come in and get your license renewed if you were a station every 3 years, and the commission had a set of little guidelines. Are you talking to people in your community about what kind of programming they want? Are you covering local events, public issues, news and information, reflecting a diversity of culture? Never did a good job, the commission, of implementing those things, but at least they had something on the books. What's happened recently is almost all of those guidelines are gone, and the broadcaster now doesn't do much more than send in a postcard once every eight, not three anymore, once every 8 years. And
when I worked,
have a license, it's slam dunk.
I just want to confirm this, because when I worked in radio at WBCN in Boston, we paid a lot of attention to what was called community ascertainment.
Yeah, there you go.
Going around and meeting with community groups, having meetings, bringing people into the station, getting a sense of the issues that the community really cared about. And that became part of the renewal process of renewing our license. And then come the Reagan years, those various requirements begin to get whittled away and continue to be whittled away. I'm struck by the fact that of the members of Congress who probably, of the member of the Senate who probably knows the most about broadcasting because he was in broadcasting, is Senator Al Franken of Minnesota. And Franken worked for NBC for many, many years. He is outraged about this deal. He's outspoken about it, even though apparently he's taken some money from Comcast.
But here's the real kicker. You talk about this thing called ascertainment, the obligation of the broadcaster to go out and talk to people in his or her community. We required that back when there was such a thing as a local broadcaster, and maybe the person who owned that station lived in that town. More often than not, they did. And they went to the local bakery or barber shop or hairdresser, although there weren't many women and there still aren't enough owning these stations, but was a member of the community. Nowadays, the owner's liable to be 1,000 or 2,000 miles away, part of this huge behemoth corporation, and there's no requirement anymore for that person to go out. And so is it any wonder that they know less about what's going on in their communities? And of course, the other awful facet of what we're talking about here as a result of this consolidation has just been the cutting of journalism and the cutting of newsrooms right and left across the country. These transactions cost money. They're very expensive, so you got to finance them. So the first thing after the FCC and Justice approved these mergers, companies got to go and pay for them. Where do they make the economies? And all too often they make them in the newsroom. We've probably got it's hard to get an exact figure, but 20,000 fewer newsroom employees than we had, say, as recently as 2000. There's a lot of news that's not getting covered. There's a lot of
Michael, let me testify on that score, because I worked for ABC News for 8 years. I was at the 2020 program, and you know, over the years, what we came to see first when Disney took over ABC News, but cutbacks of various kinds that were, okay, you guys are producing segments, but now you can only use 20 tapes to make your segment. So therefore, you don't have the resources to go out and cover the story with as much depth as you would like to. You're under restraints that the public doesn't see. They don't know what's not being covered. They know what is being covered. And as a consequence, there has been a downsizing of newsrooms and you know, at the same time, more money spent on celebrity news, more money spent on sports coverage, and less money spent on hard-nosed investigative reporting.
Well, there's been a downsizing of the newsroom, like you say, and I think it's led to, be brutally frank about it, a dumbing down of our civic dialogue. Just the fact that the American people aren't being supplied with the news and information, that many stories are untold. Many stories are not even known because you don't have the reporters out there on the beat. So how do you hold truth How do you hold the powerful accountable unless you have reporters who can dig for the truth and dig for the facts? And you try and find the reporter now whose boss says, take 6 months or take 9 months or a year and go out and get the details of the story. This is really important. I mean, nowadays, the poor reporter's got to write a news story. He's got to do a blog. If they own a TV or a radio station, he or she has got to get on that station. If they're covering a story, sometimes they have to take the camera with them because they don't have a cameraman anymore. So something's got to give in a situation like that, and something has given. And I think we're at a point now where we are playing fast and loose because with our civic dialogue. We're not nourishing it the way it should be nourished. We're not, and the country faces really as serious a set of challenges as we have in a long, long time, and there's no get out of the hole, get out of the ditch free card like you have get out of jail and Monopoly. We've got some really tough decisions to make, and that depends upon an informed electorate, and increasingly we're not informing the electorate.
Well, you somehow survived all those years in Washington. I don't think I could have. But the key thing is that big money is also being given to politicians. There have been these hearings in the U.S. Senate, even though it's not the Senate that will decide this, but the Federal Communications Commission, largely. But, you know, already over since 1989, Time Warner Cable and Comcast have made a combined $42.4 million donations to various politicians and groups. And right now, there's a tremendous amount of money that's being spent on lobbying and giving gifts to politicians. Now, it's of both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party.
Right. Well, you mentioned at the outset I used to be a historian, taught history. I don't know of an age or an era going all the way back to that notorious Gilded Age and the robber barons of the 1890s, 1880s, that is so characterized by special interests and the power of money and the influence of money. And it's not just in media. I think it's especially pernicious in media, but it's just in all of these issue areas. Money buys elections, money writes laws, money makes decisions, and the country has to get serious about that problem. One place we could start, incidentally, would be to demand some disclosure of who's behind all of these anonymous and mind-numbing advertisements that we watch on TV in months and now years leading up to elections. A large part of the $10 billion that was spent during the last election campaign cycle, a good part of that, billions and billions of dollars, ended up in media to buy those ads.
Yeah, so here you have people giving money to politicians, politicians then giving the money back to the media, in a sense, and the media giving them money to lobby for what they want to do.
And all on your and my airwaves.
Yeah, the Sunlight Foundation has been examining a lot of this. It says here that the cable giant Comcast has donated in some way to 32 of the 39 members of the House Judiciary Committee, which is planning its own hearing. Comcast has canvassed the two congressional panels that chiefly regulate cable, broadband, and other telecom issues, donating to practically every lawmaker there, Republicans and Democrats.
Yep.
And they stress that their donations are a function of their business. It's all business, Michael. That's right. How they justify it.
Well, doing something about campaign spending, of course, is the heart and soul of Common Cause, where I'm spending a good bit of my time right now. It's a huge problem. You have a court that seems to be opening the dikes for all kinds of money, unlimited money. But do you know the Federal Communications Commission operates under a statute which actually requires something called sponsorship identification, and that applies not just to commercial sponsors so we know who's sponsoring something or paying for something, but it applies to political sponsors too. And again, this has been on the books for decades, way back to the beginning of the Telecommunications Act of 1934, never been enforced, but we could enforce that law, and then it's, when you watch these ads, instead of seeing a little banner on the bottom that says paid for by Citizens for Red, White, and Blue, or Citizens for Good Government, when it might be a chemical company dumping sludge into the Great Lakes, you'd actually know the commission, the way I read the statute, has the authority to do that right now. Wouldn't that be a good place to start? Again, it doesn't end the power of money, but at least you'd put that sunlight on what's going on, and people would know who was sponsoring an ad. Maybe they'd take them a little less
seriously. Well, it seems to be a topic. Seems to be a topic that the news divisions don't cover very much. Okay, they don't cover their own role in
all
this.
Well, they don't. Their ox it could be gored, you know.
And so as a consequence, we're not learning about the role of money in politics in the same way, you know, that the media people, generally speaking, will say, well, nobody's really influenced by what we do. We don't have any influence at all.
Right.
They'll say to the public. Then to the advertisers, they'll say, you know, if you advertise with us, we're going to double your sales. We're going to triple your sales. We have incredible power and influence in the marketplace. So they're speaking, they're saying one thing out of one side of their mouth and the other out of the other. So what do we do now, Michael, to deal with this issue of media and growing media concentration?
We have more people like you talking about it, and what remains of independent local radio and television and others to cover the story. What we do is tell that story to our families and our friends and our workplace colleagues, and when leaders are holding town hall meetings or whatever, we go to those and say, hey, something is wrong here, so that they know what really is an issue, because grassroots outrage can still make a difference. I can give you examples of that. But this is not a problem that's going to be resolved from the top down and as a gift from our leaders in Washington, D.C. The kind of reform I'm talking about in media democracy is going to come where all real reform has always come from, and that from the grassroots.
Okay, well, let's hope that this program will encourage that. I want to thank you, Michael Copps, for joining us on MediaChannel.org, discussing this Comcast merger and sharing your insight from all those years as a commissioner on the FCC. Thank you so much.
Well, a privilege to be on. Thank you, and keep up the good work.
Okay, we're going to go to a song now, and we're coming back with Miles Rappaport, the president of Common Cause, to discuss the Supreme Court decision. We tried to have a conversation last week. It didn't quite work. We're going to try again today, and Miles is going to be joining us on the phone. So you're on News Dissector Radio, MediaChannel.org, programming. Stick with us.
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound, is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. If you happen to be rich and you feel like a night's entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can ring ding-a-ling for the mate. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover, though you moan and you groan quite a lot, you can take it on the chin, call a cab, and begin to recover on your 14-carat yacht. Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, of that we can be sure. I'm being poor.
Money, 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 money.
Thank you.
Okay, Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Now it's time to introduce our next guest. Miles Rapaport is the new president of Common Cause, the leading organization in our country that's fighting the influence of big money in politics. Miles was running Demos, a think tank here in New York. Before that, he was a politician, really, in Connecticut. He's had a lot of experience in politics and running, you know, an important think tank, and now running an important organization for our whole country. So last week, we tried to have Miles with us. We had some problems. He's back. Miles, welcome to Media Channel Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here, and I apologize for the phone misconnections we had last week. I think it was the fault was on my end, not yours.
Well, I'll take the blame, okay? I'm a big guy. I'll take the blame. But here's the point. Could you introduce yourself? I've given you a little bit of an introduction, but tell me a little bit about your why you've gone to Common Cause and what your hopes are as the new president of Common Cause.
Well, I spent the last 13 years at BMOS, you know, which is a fabulous public policy center in New York, committed to two fundamental issues, an economy where everybody has an equal chance and a democracy where everybody has an equal say. And I really felt great about the work that we had done there and are continuing to do there. But the opportunity to lead Common Cause came up, and I thought about it this way, which is Common Cause is a major national organization but also institution. It's really a national brand when it comes to political reform and democracy reform. And it, it has a 43-year history founded by John Gardner. Really was responsible for, you know, much of the original campaign finance rules that came in after Watergate and has fought for them, you know, since then. And it's a national grassroots organization where there are 400,000 members all around the country, you know, a significant, donor base and 35 local chapters around the country. So it felt to me like here's an organization that is, committed to the very same issues that I've been working on really all my life, not just at Demos. It's got Bob Reich, the leading advocate in the country, really, for, dealing with and fighting against economic inequality. So this is a great opportunity for me to take the values and experiences that I've had and, you know, try to make a real, take Common Cause forward in a really, really good way.
But aren't you taking over at a very dark time in our politics on the question of campaign finance reform in the aftermath of the McCutcheon decision by the U.S. Supreme Court and the threat to all campaign finance rules and regulations, the allowance of people to make giant contributions, as much as 1.2 million per donor in a 2-year election cycle. We're in a situation where big money seems to be effectively taking over our political system, and it's often not reported on by the media, at least not in terms of what its implications are.
No, I would partly share that analysis, partly not. I definitely think that it's a very miserable time if the standard of judgment is what is the view of the United States Supreme Court on these issues and what is the, you know, how much money is flowing into the election. But I also think it's a really interesting time because I think that two things. One, there is more focus and more energy on these democracy issues, I would call them, than there has been in a very, very long time. I mean, if you think back to the 2012 election, you know, there was real serious conversation, mainstream conversation about Sheldon Adelson and the super PACs and now the Sheldon Adelson primary, they're calling it, in the Republican Party, which is really quite remarkable. And there was a lot of discussion about voter suppression.
Let's take those issues. Let's take those issues one at a time, just to remind people what we're talking about, the so-called Sheldon primary, when four potential candidates for the Republican presidential nomination went to Las Vegas in March to court this casino owner and, you know, and right-wing Zionist supporter of Israel. And Roberts, the Chief Justice, basically said that ingratiation and access are not corruption by any means. So here we have, in a sense, one of the most blatant interferences in the political system, with one very high stakes, high roller billionaire essentially deciding who he's going to support, and all of these candidates coming to court his support.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like it's a caricature of the way the system actually works. I mean, there's no question, and it's been this way for a very long time, as campaigns have become more and more expensive, candidates, and I was one, so I know where I speak on this, you know, spend an extraordinary amount of time cultivating high donors, people who can max out their campaigns, and of course now with the McCutcheon decision, maxing out has a whole new meaning. And you start to think, if you're a candidate and all the people you're talking to every day are rich people that you want to get to contribute to your campaign, that the problems that they talk about, environmental regulations are too tough, taxes on the wealthy are too high, you know, regulations on Wall Street are restraining financial innovation, you know, you name it, those are the issues. Those become the issues of the political discussion. And you don't call people who say, you know, I'm a single mother and I'm having trouble paying for childcare for my kid. You know, I'm a student and I'm saddled with student debt and I can't pay anything. Because those aren't the people who are going to write you $1,000 checks for your campaign, much less $1 million checks. So, yes, this has been a real problem, but I do think that there are responses to it and antidotes to it, and I think that's the fight we have to have.
Well, alongside of it, there seem to be two other problems, in my view. One is the problem that you were alluding to earlier, which is new rules and regulations at the state level, which make it harder for people to register to vote, that seem to be discriminating against minorities once again in many of these, discouraging voters rather than encouraging them. So that's one issue. And this seems to be full speed ahead on the part of the Republican Party and many of the groups that revolve around it to try to stop minorities particularly from voting. Is this something that concerns you and worries you?
Yes, very much so. You know, this has become a shameful, in my view, tactic that that some states have been adopting and that some legislators are pushing, to just make it harder for people to register, make it harder for people to vote. I mean, North Carolina right now is the poster child for this, where they had some pretty positive election laws up until the Tea Party and Art Pope take over in 2010. And they repealed the election day voter, same day voter registration with early voting. They limited the early voting times. They enacted voter identification laws, etc.
Isn't that just blatant? Isn't it like totally, you know, obvious? Where is the Justice Department in all of this?
Well, it's interesting. The Justice Department, in 2010 and for the 2012 election cycle, the Justice Department, using the mechanism of the Voting Rights Act, did in fact intervene in a lot of these states where they had, which were covered by Title V of the Voting Rights Act, and stopped these laws from taking place. And of course, what has happened since then is that in the Shelby, decision of the Supreme Court, busy opening the floodgates of for high donors, took out that the most effective enforcement mechanism of the Voting Rights Act. And again, it's a terrible judicial precedent. And what we need is a significant and strong, response and fighting back, both at the state and the federal level.
And ironically,
I will say, Dan, that the good news is that in a lot of states, real progress has been made in opening up the voting process. You know, five states in the District of Columbia, including the District of Columbia, have adopted same-day voter registration just in the last 4 years. A number of states, even some red states, are adopting online voter registration, making it a lot easier to register. So that there are, there's two trends. There's a trend towards pushing forward and opening up the process, and the trend towards looking backwards, and that's the same on the campaign finance issue.
The other issue that, of course, concerns us at MediaChannel.org is the role the media is playing on all of this. Now, of course, with the Supreme Court decision, there's been quite a bit of media coverage of the decision and its implications. But in the ordinary, ordinary way politics is covered, we very rarely, we have a lot of attention paid to issues, very little to interest, very little to explaining in a story where this candidate got his money from or her money from. This candidate may be echoing the special interests of a particular group of donors. Usually that's an election issue story, one story, but it doesn't really seem to seep into the day-to-day coverage of politics. Does that concern you?
Well, I was very happy that you just had Michael Kaufman, who's the director of the Media and Democracy Program at Common Cause. So we're very proud of the work that he's doing and Todd O'Boyle is doing with him to make all those to raise these issues. But yeah, it's a deep concern. As the media consolidation takes place and there's fewer and fewer reporters that are really digging into these things, I think it's a major problem that we that needs to be regulated, and of course, the same people who are fighting regulation of Wall Street are fighting regulation of the media.
Well,
but I don't think the media has done enough of its job. Some have. There have been some good stories, and I do think that it is getting into the public consciousness, the issue of money in politics and the fact that big donors and super PACs and, major individual donors are having an excessive influence on the process. I don't think people think that we can do very much about it. That becomes the job of Common Cause and organizations like it to say, yes, we can pass the public financing law the way we did in Connecticut, and it makes a difference.
Go figure. I mean, Stephen Colbert seems to be on his way to CBS now. Took on the big super PACs and educated all of his viewers about it and helped make it an issue. So one or two really motivated media people can bring these issues, which have been tended to be treated obscurely, and bring them to public attention. And one of the things that I'm really impressed by is online, the number of organizations like the Sunlight Foundation, like the Center for Public Integrity, the Center for Responsive Politics, and the other groups that are really tracking all of these donations and making it available through websites and through outreach efforts. So there are more people who are spending time in a kind of sophisticated tabulation of where all this money is going and where it's coming from. But in a sense, that still is up against the wall of a media system that's more interested in 24-hour coverage of where the Malaysian plane is at this moment.
Right. Well, the same is true on the voting side, and that is that there's been substantial and very successful pushback going back to 2012 again from civil rights organizations, voting rights organizations, the ACLU, Demos, Common Cause, other organizations that really pushed back against these laws. And in fact, in I think the exact statistic is that in 2012, of 16 voter identification laws that were passed by the state, only three of them actually went into effect for the 2012 elections, some combination of being put on the ballot and overturned, court cases, the Justice Department, et cetera. So, they're not, there's definitely a huge effort at voter suppression on the right and also at unleashing the power of big money on the right, but I don't think they're doing it in an uncontested way, and that's, I think, our job.
How can we help? How can people in the media help spotlight these issues? How can we track and report on Common Cause's work more thoroughly? How can we help the public understand these issues more? Because, just as I was criticizing maybe major media for trivializing or only focusing on certain issues that seem to excite the audience, a lot of the online sites also are given to what are called, clickbait, sexy headlines, celebrity news, and all the rest of it. I mean, it seems like there is a definite need for more coverage of these issues.
I would definitely agree. I mean, I think there are a lot of, the proliferation of of sources online, you know, at one level is a good thing, and then the other level it's hard to, you know, make your way through all of the clutter. I think that some really good reportage has been done. You know, I think of the American Prospect, I think of the Nation, you know, in many ways have really taken the statistics that are available and helped to make the case. So I think partly it's up to the organizations, I'll take Common Cause as an example, to do everything we can do to push out the work that we're doing so that people do know about it, more so than they do. And with people, you know, like yourself who are in the media, pushing to make the work known. And I guess part of it is not simply emphasizing the problems and the power of money and the overwhelming, nature of it, but also to concentrate and lift up the successful fight backs, which are going on in many, many places.
Well, I think I've been guilty of that a little bit. You know, sort of too much analysis can lead to paralysis, okay? Can lead to sort of a pessimistic view. We have no hope. Forget about it. We can't achieve anything. When, in fact, we have, you know, staring in the face so many groups and organizations that are having an impact, okay? I mean, the surveillance issue, getting out of control. One guy, Snowden, in a way, sort of brought the National Security Agency into public, disrepute and has forced this issue on the agenda. So, you know, I think when we get into a sort of pessimistic, negative approach to things, nothing happens. And I like your spirit here because you acknowledge that there are serious problems. You acknowledge the challenges, but you also want to share information about how these other campaigns in various states have worked and have been successful.
Yeah, I really feel strongly about that because I think that I do think we're entering a period. This is, you know, my own view. Where the kind of the hegemony, what I would call it, of the conservative viewpoint that has been pretty much dominant over the last, 35 years, on and off, I think it's coming to an end. I think, President Obama's election, I think some of the other elections around the country, Mayor de Blasio in New York is an example, you know, where progressives are getting elected, and new ideas are coming forward, and I think it's really contested terrain for the next 5 or 7 years, and I think that gives a major responsibility to organizations like Common Cause and outlets like your own to highlight where the fight is and where we can make progress.
You know, because I know that there are a lot of, you know, young people coming out of journalism schools or coming out of media programs who really are motivated to try to do something that serves the public interest. They're not just out there to, be part of the kind of Hollywood cheerleading squad. You know, they want to deal with the serious problems, and the problems of immigration reform is one of them. The problems of persistent and pervasive discrimination and racism, which still exists, although it's kind of when you raise it somehow, you're considered outside the consensus. But I think there needs to be more honesty and truth in media, and I fear sometimes that our president, who, you know, is elected to represent the hopes of so many people, has sort of turned in the other direction. He's just, you know, in terms of the way he's regarded whistleblowers, the way he's aligned himself with the intelligence agencies, with big media, big banks, and the like. And this must create an environment where you have a base that undoubtedly is supportive of Democrats, although I know it's a nonpartisan group, Common Cause. At the same time, can you raise your concerns with the White House and with the people in politics? Just today, Nancy Pelosi, you know, said, well, we can't stop deportations because if we do, the Republicans will eat us for lunch.
Right. Well, look, it's a very difficult, political environment with a tremendously, you know, sort of intractable opposition, you know, that only was heightened when President Obama, as the first African American president, was elected. I don't think there's any question that there's a connection here. But here's an interesting example where I do think that raising the issue, putting it forward, changing the conversation can change the policy. And that's on the issue of minimum wage and low wage work, where, you know, a lot of organizations, whether it's the SEIU and some of the labor unions, some of the immigration groups, have really been pushing for a real genuine conversation about whether we really want to be an $8 an hour economy. And, you know, Demos and other organizations put forward a report that said that, you know, President Obama could, by executive order, raise the wages for hundreds of thousands of people, just by saying that anybody who works on a federal contract can't get less than $10.10 an hour. And, lo and behold, you know, pushing, and, in the State of the Union message, he did exactly that. And I think that, you know, there are examples, you know, there are certainly examples where the overwhelming negativity has prevailed, but there are also some green shoots, I would call them, that say the conversation is changing. Look at the inequality issue. 6 years ago, we were talking about the inequality is getting worse and worse and worse, and no one's talking about it. Today, it is a genuine, serious subject of conversation at political levels. And I think when that happens, the policies will change as well. Not without opposition, not without a major fight, but I think it can happen.
Well, here's something obscure for you, but just today I was meeting an Italian student, okay, comes from Bologna, the home of Antonio Gramsci, okay? And Gramsci was one of these great theoreticians in Italy, but he was known for a saying that was sort of, I'm hearing in this conversation, which is pessimism of the intelligence, optimism of the will. In other words, we can allow ourselves to be bummed out. We can allow ourselves to think that nothing can change or will change, or we can actually engage in the process of trying to make it happen. And what we find is that a lot of people are looking for leadership. They're looking for a direction to move in. And it's possible with the right approach, and a media strategy, I think, has to be part of that approach,
yep,
that you and Common Cause can play a new role in sort of igniting a sense of possibility on the part of the audience. Am I too optimistic here?
No, I think not. I mean, if you go back 15 years ago, you know, there was a general sense that the only place where new ideas were coming from was the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, and the Manhattan Institute, and all these kind of conservative places. And 15 years later, although, you know, you can look at the statistics, inequality has gotten worse, money in politics has gotten worse, you know, so it's not, I don't want to be Pollyanna here. But the playing field has been significantly leveled. There is more of a voice for progressive ideas, for pro-democracy ideas, than there was back then. I think that that's why I say I think we're in a very interesting period of contested, you know, terrain, and I think that there's a real possibility that things are on their way towards changing for the better. And it's our responsibility as people, both of us who have been involved in these issues for a long time, to just try to do everything we can to make it happen.
Let me just express a hope, Miles, because I first met you in Boston, your community organizer, and went into politics in Connecticut. You were very successful and very respected there. Came to New York and really gave an unknown think tank, Demos, a profile that it didn't have before. Now you've moved into Washington, into the Beltway. And, you know, the danger is getting, you know, kind of drowning in all of the internal debates of Washington and getting caught up in it. How are you going to try to keep yourself from succumbing to that D.C. syndrome?
Right. Well, one of the real attractions, as I said, about Common Cause is that it's doing so much work at the state level. And there's no question in my mind that in terms of actually making serious policy progress over the next few years, you know, where you have a gridlock Congress, which I hope will change, but where you know is going to be at the state level. So I'm going to work very closely with the 35 state Common Cause chapters. They in turn are going to work more closely with other organizations in the states to really make some progress in those laboratories of democracy that are the states. So I'm going to try to make sure that I keep my feet grounded at work that's really being successful at the state level, and at the same time try to be involved in as principled a way as possible in the public debates here in Washington.
Thank you so much, Miles Rappaport, for joining us on Media Channel Radio and offering your perspectives as a reformer in Washington who also recognizes the importance of media. So thank you, Miles Rappaport.
Thank you, Danny. I must invite people to come to commoncause.org, see all the work that we're doing, and join us.
Thank you so much. To comment on the program, you can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. You'll be able to read this interview online and also on mediachannel.org. We welcome your comments. We welcome your thoughts here in Progressive Radio Network. Thank you again for joining us.
I pledge allegiance to the card of the United States of Credit. One nation under debt, with bankruptcies, late fees, and high interest for all.
We're doomed to shop till we drop.
Shopping is the American addiction. Borrowing and debt.
In debt, we trust.
It's kind of hard to serve the master and MasterCard.
I just need your signature right here, please.